Welcome to The Fighting Priests, a podcast exploring orthodoxy and jiu-jitsu. Two paths, one struggle. Father Ted Paraskevopoulos and Father Thomas Sandberg are two orthodox Christian priests who also happen to be practitioners of jiu-jitsu. Together, they explore how these two unique worlds intersect and what it means for our spirituality. Here's Father Ted and Father Thomas. All right, well, welcome everybody back to The Fighting Priests again. This is our second episode. I'm here with Father Thomas Sandberg. Father, how's it going?
I'm okay. How about yourself?
I'm all right. You know, as the world knows, we're all in the middle of a lockdown, you know, the coronavirus pandemic. So I know we had talked about, maybe we're not going to talk about it on this podcast, and we aren't going to talk about it a lot, but I'm all the way here in Toronto. You're all the way up in Niverville near Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Yeah.
And we're all locked down. So we got lots of time to do podcasts, which is great. So, we are into our second episode. And this week, we were going to be talking about a little bit about the history of BJJ, where it comes from, and, you know, how it relates to our faith, as we usually do. But first of all, I'd like to ask you any kind of announcements, anything you've heard, because, you know, now it's been total lockdown across the whole world and total lockdown across, you know, jiu-jitsu tournaments as well. You know, everything's been shut down. We had quite a few coming up this spring. Have you heard anything, any kind of news in the world of BJJ? Any updates?
Nope. The only organization that's still holding events is Chael Sonnen's Submission Underground. They hold them at like some secret location, I guess. I don't know. The windows are all blacked out and there's no crowd or nothing. You can watch it on UFC Fight Pass. They had one week ago, 2 weeks ago, Craig Jones against Kevin Casey. Mm-hmm. And another one coming up. Can't remember the date, maybe the end of April. So although other than that, everything's canceled. So
yeah, I know it's very difficult. Like I know we had quite a few people, including our instructor Joel Gershon, who was preparing for a tournament this spring, and everything got canceled. So yeah. And I know everybody's getting antsy, you know, because when you're training what, like 3 maybe 4 times a week, and then you go from that to nothing, it's a big transition.
Yep. Or if you're training more than that in a week for the past 9 years to then not training anymore, it's pretty strange.
How often were you going?
Because of school, man, I don't even know. I know for sure I'd make it on, I train twice a day on Fridays and then Saturdays and Sundays after liturgy, Monday night, and then usually Wednesday, and then maybe a Tuesday or Thursday, but it was dependent on the liturgical schedule or where we had to be, stuff like that. Obviously, before I was in school, then you're training every day. So
that's good. Well, for us who have children, yeah. I got 3, so it's I'd love to be training like 6-7 times a week. But for me, it's usually 3 to 4 times a week, and that's quite a bit considering I also take my son George. So you know, and you know he's 8 years old. And when he first started training, we were only taking him 2 times a week. And then after like a couple of months, he asked to go more, which was a delight. And so, you know, I'm taking him Monday nights, Tuesday nights, Wednesday nights. And then I'm training as well, you know, at lunchtime on Mondays and nighttimes on Wednesdays and Fridays again. And then try to get in a fourth sometimes. So, but like you said, you know, being Orthodox priest as well, it's hard, right? Because we have a full liturgical schedule. Mm-hmm. We have pastoral obligations, and you know, you don't have your own parish yet. You're just finishing up seminary, but it gets even harder when you have a full parish, right? And carving at that time. But going from that to zero now has been very difficult.
Yeah. Yep. Just lifting weights and running and that's it. Stretching, watching instructionals. So
Yeah. It's I've been running as well, and trying to keep somewhat in shape and doing a lot of online instructionals and seminars and things like that. But it's not the same. It's not the same. So hopefully this will pass quickly and everybody can get back to all the things that they love, and we can get back on the mats as soon as possible, because we definitely need it. So yeah, here's looking forward to a quick resolution to this crisis. Thank you. this week, we wanted to focus a little bit on the history of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is a little bit different than classical Japanese Jiu-Jitsu. And I want to ask Father Thomas to give us a little bit of a background on, you know, where Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu comes from, why Brazil, who created it, why is it so popular today? Father?
This is a controversial topic these days now. There's different people have different versions of the story. Every story, when it's simply told, is always going to be, I think, inaccurate or, you know, a short version. But essentially, the story goes, if you trace the history of from Japan, you end up getting this character name, if I pronounce it correctly, Mitsuyo Maeda, who ends up in Brazil. There was a large Japanese, I guess, immigrant population there at the time. And the story goes, he knew Helio Gracie's father was a lawyer, and he was going to help him get citizenship or help the community or something like that. And he said, in exchange for this, I will teach your kids jiu-jitsu. And this is where some people say he taught them judo. The Gracies themselves have always said, Helio has always been adamant that, no, he taught us jiu-jitsu. He didn't teach us judo. So whatever he taught them, he came. I think the significant thing and what would later on influence the approach taken by the Gracies was the fact that Maeda believed that you had to fight. Right? You had to, if you were saying that this works, you have to show that it works. So he believed in taking challenge matches, which some people, there's like this view in more traditional martial arts that fighting for money is dishonorable or something. Then you have other people who think it's actually dishonorable not to fight. If you're going to say that you can defend yourself, or you're going to teach this to people to defend themselves, but you're not going to actually show yourself that you can do it or that it's effective, that's actually, that could actually be harmful to people, because people can end up getting hurt if you're actually teaching them techniques that don't work.
And this is a huge, I don't want to say controversy, but there's a big dichotomy even in modern day martial arts with this, right? You know, more traditional martial arts that focus on katas and form, and, you know, it's almost like, as beautiful as it is, it's almost like a beautiful choreography sometimes, mm-hmm. even when people are getting graded and things like that. But in a lot of martial arts, there isn't this kind of like, you know, practical aspect of putting what you know into actual practice in a real scenario, in a real fight, right? So like you said, it's hard to gauge what a person actually does know and how effective it would be in real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the story goes, I guess Helio Gracie was a weak child. This part's very disputed as well, but whatever, eventually one day his brother Carlos, who's the older brother, they end up teaching jiu-jitsu to people. And one day he's not there for a class or something like that. And Helio ends up teaching this class because he'd been watching. And so Carlos arrives back and is like, oh, I'm so sorry, I wasn't there. And the guy says, no problem, that's okay. But from now on, I'd like to be taught by your younger brother here. And so this is where this Helio starts teaching. And then from there, the story goes, Carlos decides to dedicate himself to this thing that he develops called the Gracie Diet, and so he can kind of help Helio get strong, I guess. This is a controversial mm-hmm. thing as well. But it goes, but I don't know, food, everyone knows, like the ancient Greeks taught this, that food is your medicine. So mm-hmm. So food and exercise, and then next thing you know, then they start pushing forth jiu-jitsu, and you say this is the best form of self-defense, and then they start taking challenge matches. You can see a lot of these old challenge matches on, I guess, old film. You can find them on the internet.
Yep.
But it's this idea of fighting to show, right, to putting things into action, that eventually leads, once jiu-jitsu comes to America, Horian Gracie comes to America. I think he came twice. The first time wasn't as successful. The second time he came, and he was teaching jiu-jitsu in his garage, I guess, in California. There was also another family member, Carly Gracie, who was somewhere else in America and was trying to teach jiu-jitsu, but it wasn't having success. So some people argue that when the UFC was created, it was more like an infomercial for Gracie jiu-jitsu, right? Because they had all these challenge matches. You can find these old tapes. Even Steve Maxwell talks about the challenge matches, right? The people would come in. And so they kind of create the UFC with this idea to show, as me, essentially no rules, no time limit, and we're gonna show what that Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, is the most superior form of self-defense, right? So,
So just for our listeners who may not know who the Gracies are, you know, they're considered the largest martial arts family in the world, just because of the descendants, right? The amount of actual family members who are actually practicing, correct?
Yeah, they're probably the most influential family in all of martial arts, probably of all time, if you look at history.
Sure. Because now it's the grandchildren of Helios Gracie and his brothers who are basically spreading. And of course, you know, they've branched out and they have different schools and different kind of like movements and things like that. But it's the third generation now that's carrying it forward. So it's a huge...
maybe even fourth generation, depending. Yeah, I think
fourth. Well, they're definitely having babies now. So they do have a fourth generation coming in, right? Wow. So it's a huge family. And of course, there are a lot of other people who are influential in the BJJ world. But they are definitely the first and the ones who brought it to North America, especially. And augmented it. The mythology, as far as I understand it, and you spoke a little bit about it, was that, yeah, Helios was the weaker of the brothers, and that he had no choice but to augment.
Yeah,
classic jiu-jitsu.
He adapted the Japanese jiu-jitsu, or the Kano jiu-jitsu, as it was also called. And so, he adapted the moves. I said it's hard to, if you look this up, to see what exactly he changed. They always say leverage. They say not as much strength, or, you know, the whole thing. It's hard to say. I think the biggest thing you can see is the development, or the use of the closed guard as a weapon. And then from there, the open guard, and then all the things that branch off from there into modern Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu that all come off. So you can see, like, the closed guard, the guy opens a guard, open guard, the guy steps this way, and you can see you can trace all the developments of how all these things branched off from the closed guard. I think that's even with Robert Drysdale was making a documentary for a long time now about the origins of BJJ. And that's what he calls his documentary, Closed Guard. So we'll see when it actually comes out and what it says. But I think he is also coming from the point of view that they were taught judo, and then it developed from there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but
I have a quote here from Helio Gracie. He said, the jiu-jitsu is for the protection of the individual, the older man, the weak, the child, the lady, the young woman, from being dominated and hurt by others because they don't have the physical attributes to defend themselves like I never had. Mm-hmm. He believed that, you know, this was a superior style because, yes, not only the leverage, but just the technique was more important than sheer power.
And strength. The key is also against untrained people, right? Yeah. Because now once you have two people who are trained, and then one person is stronger, that's a whole different thing. Then it becomes more like a competition rather than a challenge to prove styles or a self-defense thing. It becomes a competition, like an athletic endeavor.
All right. Well, Father, thank you for that. Kind of background in, you know, kind of Gracie Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is, like, you know, an offshoot of classical Japanese Jiu-Jitsu, how it kind of started in Brazil, came to America. Now it's you know, it's huge everywhere. We see it all over the world. It's very, very popular. The thing that kind of really made me interested in Jiu-Jitsu beyond you being involved in it, but also what kind of made me really enjoy it when I first started doing it, is that there's this idea that there needs to be humility in jiu-jitsu. Like, there are a lot of people who are not humble and they're practicing jiu-jitsu, but to really be good and to really kind of take in what your instructors are trying to teach you, and especially the first year, and sometimes more than the first year when you're a white belt, you're going to go through a lot of hardships. You're going to go through a lot of, like, humiliation in a good sense, and you're going to go through a lot of, you know, humbling experiences where you're going to realize you really know nothing and you have a lot to learn. And this reminds me, like, these difficulties and this kind of these tribulations, these hardships that we go through the first year or sometimes 2 years of jiu-jitsu reminds me of St. Paul's words in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 10, when he says, that is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties, for when I am weak, then I am strong. And this is the title of our podcast today, you know, when I am weak, I'm strong. And I think this perfectly describes at least my personal experience this last year, this last five and a half, 6 months, that, you know, in weakness, there is strength. That, you know, there's a saying in jiu-jitsu, and I'm sure you've heard it before, that, you know, you either win or you learn. You don't win or lose.
Yeah.
They say that, right?
Yeah. People say that. Yeah.
Maybe yeah, that's true. Saying it to make themselves feel better.
Yeah, that's usually what you say after you lose a tournament in your Instagram post. No, but it's true. Even I was just watching a video this morning of Jocko Willink, and I think Nicky Rodriguez had posted it, and he was talking about that. Why, when everything is bad, do you say good? He's right, because these are opportunities for growth, opportunities to learn more, to get better. So,
yeah, you know, it's I was told when I first started. You told me, and also many other people told me, is don't expect to win. Don't expect to submit anybody. Don't expect to be able to master anything, but expect the first year just to be constantly submitted. And that's going to be difficult, because who wants to go to do a martial art, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a week, where all you do is go there, and then you're just getting, you know, you're getting put into different submissions. You're getting choked out. You know, it's not a fun feeling. And it's just failure after failure after failure. And I didn't understand that when I first started. It was a very demeaning experience. And I don't mean demeaning like in a bad way, but it was very humbling. You know, it's like, here I am, nobody. I may be a priest in my parish and people respect me. And, you know, I may have studied theology many years and people consider me pretty competent in that area. But here I am nothing. And it's very healthy. It's very healthy for the soul. And I also realized that by losing every time, I would ask, you know, every time I would roll with somebody and they would do something, I didn't know what they did. And then I would stop and I would ask questions like, how did you do that? How do I change? How do I protect myself better? What am I doing wrong? And, you know, almost everybody that has been, at least in my club, has been very, very helpful. You know, people just will take the time to sit down with you and explain and break things down. And then you start doing it less, you know, making the mistakes less, and you become more effective and you grow. But you can't grow, I find, in jiu-jitsu without failing first, without going through the hardships. I don't know, like, how was your experiences the first few years when you first got into it?
Feels like that all the time, even now. Like, it's different, especially when I got to Toronto, when I joined Toronto BJJ as a pro belt, because it's it's a different level there. It's, I remember there when I was a pro belt, man, it was very hard. It was very, and then once I adapted to the level of training and the level of training partners, then you get better. But there's a lot of people who do that. They don't, you know, a lot of people, when they face adversity, you can go to a different club, you go to an easier club, you can just quit. A lot of people do that, even at higher belts. But when I was a white belt, it was, same as yours. I don't ask very many questions like the way some people do. I'm more like an observer, I guess, you know, and I think to myself, or then I do ask people, but usually after, when you're stretching after, go over stuff, I'm more that way. Mm-hmm. But definitely when you're a white belt, you make the same mistakes. I just remember when I was a white belt, I kept getting my head, when you start on your knees, push down. And then I wake up in the morning and I had to hold my head to get out of bed, my neck. And then eventually it was my friend Chris, because he's a brown belt now, and he would always do that to me. So eventually, once I figured it out, then you see a little progress, and then you see the things that were happening to you are no longer happening to you. So now instead you counter and you take his back, right? So you see little victories make you feel better about all the non-victories you encounter all the time.
So wrapping up today's podcast, Father Thomas, I was reflecting a little bit this week about how, you know, hardships and difficulties can often, and I wouldn't say even often, I would say it's all a matter of how we choose. As Orthodox Christians, we believe this, that, you know, everything that happens to us in our lives can be for our salvation, can be for our betterment if we choose to use them in that way. And I find that it's the same thing in jiu-jitsu. So, you know, things that have happened to me in the last 5.5 months, things that would be considered to be negative, for example, like mild injuries, they weren't actually negatives, but they actually turned out to be positives. So I was talking about this a couple months ago. You know, I had bruised my left ribs. Somebody had flipped me and I'd landed the wrong way, and I'm a big guy and it bruised my ribs and it was hurting. And so every time I would roll, you know, I had this pain on my left side. And you know, people said, well, why don't you stop training or take a couple of weeks off just so you can, you know, heal, so you don't get a bigger injury, things like that. And I didn't stop training, obviously. I kept going. But what I found from that injury, of the many little tiny injuries that I've had last half year, is that it forced me to change my game. Originally, what I was doing, because I'm a big guy, is that I was not very good. I'm still not very good at guard. When I'm sitting on the ground and somebody's trying to pass my guard, I'm not that fast. I'm bulky. I'm slow. And people pass my guard very easily. And I had gotten into a pattern of just kind of like lying down, and the person would just come jump on top and get into side control. And I thought, oh, it's not that bad. I'm a big guy. Usually the guy who I'm rolling with is smaller. I'll just, you know, shrimp out, or, you know, turn on my side, and, or I'll just use brute force and strength and I'll push him off me and I'll get out. And that's what I was doing. But that wasn't a very good thing to do from a technique point of view, because if I got a bigger guy, you know, or somebody who's a black belt,
bad habit to get into. If you for competing, you just give up 2 points.
That's right. That's right. So it's bad all over. So I was doing that, yeah. But the rib injury, you know, forced me to change, because I couldn't do that anymore. Because, you know, for our listeners, you know, side control is when somebody kind of comes to the side, either left or right hand side, and they basically put their body right on top of you and they compress on top of you, and it's not a fun. It's a horrible position to be in, right? Because if the person's very good at what they're doing, you can't breathe sometimes. It's hard to breathe. It's hard to like turn your neck. It makes you vulnerable to a lot of attacks. And so it's not a good position to be in. And, you know, I was letting it happen way too much. But with my ribs being hurt, I couldn't do that anymore. I had to find a different way. So it forced me to work on my guard. It forced me to do more exercises, to move faster, to avoid getting in that position. And that was an injury that forced me to do that. It forced me to elevate another part of my game. So now that my ribs are healed, I found that my overall technique had gotten a lot better, because I had to protect that part of my body and I couldn't be lazy anymore. And so I don't know if that makes sense to you. I don't know if that ever happened to you in your experience of training the last 9 years. But I found that definitely the injuries can be blessings, can be avenues towards progress.
Yeah, adversity is always a good thing. I think it was Father Seraphim of Sarov who said about he's talking about the passions, right? Because there's a way of looking at the passions like they're all negative. But it's more like what you're oriented towards. It's like, if you think about it, if you were never hungry, you would starve to death because you'd never eat, right? So adversity isn't always a bad thing. It can be used to help us grow, something like that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, thank you, Father. It's been a great session. Thank you for the insight on the history of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, a little bit of your insight on adversity and how weakness makes us also strong. And I look forward to our next episode, which will be in 2 weeks. And we'll see everybody back then at that time. In the meantime, we do hope everybody does visit our Facebook group or Instagram, or like and subscribe on our podcast. We should be on iTunes as well very soon. We're just waiting for that. So we do thank everybody who's been listening so far. And we got a lot of great episodes coming up soon, and also some upcoming guests, which we'll be announcing probably in the upcoming episode. So thanks again, Father. Be safe, and we'll talk soon.
All right. See ya.
Take care.
You have been listening to The Fighting Priests, an independent podcast. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram and let us know your thoughts. We'd love to hear from you. Till next time, keep training the body and the soul. God bless.